Radio Ghana.
A very good evening and welcome to Behind the News, where you get the last word on the day's topical stories. My name is Ibrahim Kwati, and tonight, members of Labour Commission inaugurated in Accra to supposedly deal with all the labour troubles by workers. Will this commission be up to the task? Ghana police to send 90 of its men to Somalia. For what? Security experts are questioning the decision. United Nations chalks up 68 milestone tomorrow as the international body lived up to what it was established for. And heart diseases and their relation to consumption of fatty foods and saturated oil. British doctor says there is no link, but his research has been questioned by several medical experts. We get a view from the Cardio Center at Kolebu. Stay tuned for the next 1 hour as we bring you details of all these stories on our program tonight. Your comments are welcome by text on 02-666-77570. Text line again is 02-666-77570. We begin with the United Nations. Has the United Nations lived up to the expectations of its founders, and could it ever do? The UN is an international organization formed in 1945 to maintain and sustain world peace and security, the coming together of nation states, and the need to cooperate in solving international economic, social, cultural, and humanitarian problems. Currently, it has 192 member states, including every sovereign state in the world. The purpose for the formation of the UN as well was to have a place to engender discussions among countries and to prevent wars and conflicts between and among countries. Behind the News tonight through the searchlight on the UN as it celebrates its 68th year of existence and ask if the organization has succeeded in stopping wars in the world and bringing countries together. Dr. Vladimir Mchidanso is a senior research fellow, Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy, Lesia. Doc, you're welcome.
You're welcome, too. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, Doc. So, Doc, would you say the UN has lived up to its expectations, especially with regard to the purpose for which it was formed?
Well, somehow it has done very well, except that I wouldn't say they haven't lived up to it. They have had problems in trying to live up to its expectations, and therefore wouldn't write them off as such. You know, new things are coming up, but the structure of the UN is such that it cannot cope up with the new phenomena, intrastate conflicts and things like that. It was set up on a state-centric basis, so it is state-to-state relationship. Unfortunately, more and more things are making the state-to-state relationship problematic. Globalization, the trans-border kind of problems, issues in national boundaries and things like that, which the United Nations was not structured for. And these are the problems they are facing. And therefore, wouldn't write them off as that. They've done well. We haven't had a very serious third war since it was incepted. And for that alone, we say that it has done well. And it has helped in several economic and social spheres and bringing about developing countries to some level of development. So I would say they've done fairly well.
Doc, let's situate it within the context of modern times. Would you say, once again, that the UN is relevant in modern times, since there isn't any sort of metamorphosis that would enable the UN to deal with challenges currently facing the world?
I would say it should be written off. I mean, the UN has problems, as I've already said. And what you need to do is to restructure the UN in order to be able to fulfill the aspirations of its member states and especially the peoples of the world. So it needs restructuring. I wouldn't say it's not relevant. It is extremely relevant as we all look for a modicum of some kind of global normative through global governance. And it's the only institution one can look at and say, well, we can all now meet and say we want X, we want Y. And so I wouldn't write them off. I wouldn't write the organization off. I wouldn't subscribe to any persons or any idea which says that it has outlived its usefulness and it must be scraped off. I can imagine the type of chaos would have had. What we need is a proper restructuring, because a lot of bigger countries are trying to manipulate the UN to their advantage, and that is what is worrisome.
Right, Doc, talk of proper restructuring, I beg your pardon. What are the indicators? What are you talking about? The restructuring should be situated within what kind of context?
The context is clear. In 1945, we had just finished a war. And so the what brought about the whole war, the historical context, was such that states must be put in some proper kind of context. Germany should be down, bring Russia and China in, Europe, the victors kind of organization. So what we have is the P5, the permanent five, who wield veto powers. And when the whole world says we want A and one member says I do not want it, the whole thing crumbles. I do not think we need that now that we are almost all getting towards some kind of normative ethic in global governance, global economics, and everything like that. That's number one. And I as I speak now, we may all remember when Kofi Annan tried in earnest to change the structure of the UN through the 16-member eminent panel and through consensus building throughout the world. But unfortunately, the big powers again don't allow it, especially America. That's number one. Number two, a whole lot of things are happening today. Transnational border trade, the increase in trade, the increase in the use of ICT, the increase in everything is coming to a head that the world has become so small. The smaller the world, the more we need an efficient organization to make sure that things are really democratic. So we don't have a UN which is capable of doing that. Thirdly, this kind of increases have brought about also the negative aspect of globalization. Excesses in crime, drug trafficking, intrastate wars, the rise in al-Qaedaism, if you want to call it, or terrorism, whatever it is. There is nowhere in the charter where you can pinpoint and say, the charter says when we have terrorism, this is what we will do. And therefore, it's trying to play to their own advantage. You know, like in Syria, we're having the Syrian problem, and the UN is unable to solve it because it's an intrastate problem, and individual states are rather trying to intervene. So these are some of the issues where the structure of the UN does not allow the UN to be effective, you know. And when we have caused the mess, say in Iraq or in Libya, then we call on the UN to go and clear the mess. These are the things that show that the UN needs a restructuring that will clear the way for proper democratization of the UN, proper interventions in all spheres, as Kofi Annan said, that security should not be in terms of the gun and the bullet. Security should be in the totality, so that we save the succeeding generations from the scourge of war. It can be famine, it can be anything, but he didn't succeed. So we need that restructuring. I think the whole world feels we need that restructuring.
Right. Doc, let's look at the veto power. Others have described this as the biggest threat to the success of the UN. You may have all the good ideas, but you could be vetoed right away. How do we deal with the issue of veto power?
Well, it's a matter of throwing it away gradually. If you say they should give it up, they wouldn't. And so in Kofi Annan's In Larger Freedom, if you take the book or the report as it was called, you would realize that various nations, various groups, Africa had its own way of trying to ask for the restructuring. We were asking for the spread of the democratize the veto power. Let it be regionally based, if you want. Alternatively, let's have the veto power spread off, or let's regionalize it, let's make it more democratic, let's expand the P5 and things like that. So they are all there. There are ways of trying to democratize the P5 and counterbalancing their powers. All these were put forward. But again, as I said, America didn't want it. So I think the whole world would stand up and say, come on. Well, we would have to democratize it by regionalization, kind of. The P5 is just assuring them that it wouldn't be used against them. That is the way we'll go for first. Secondly, Kofi Annan was talking about we the people. After all, that is what the preamble of the UN Charter says. We the people. It didn't say we the states. So Kofi Annan wanted to universalize the idea of peace and progress and development through the people. Unites the people. When the people are united, there will be no way in which we'll have this kind of veto power being wielded. Thirdly, I think everybody is talking about regionalization in the form of regional communities like ECOWAS, SADC, NAFTA. If these communities look like Europe, EU, one policy, SADC, one policy, and that kind of thing, we would then have difficulty with the P5 getting any power at all, because they also belong to regional groups. So regionalization or regionalism has also been put forward as one of the ways of trying to make the world more peaceful and making the UN more relevant.
Right, Doc. Let's look at yet another disturbing issue, that is widespread sexual abuses. Various UN reports and interviews with humanitarian groups suggest that international peacekeeping is creating a predatory sexual culture among vulnerable refugees. I mean widespread sexual abuses. How do we deal with that?
Well, it's a question of how it's reported, because it's a crime. It's purely a crime. And so the national government should be able to deal with it. If they are not able to deal with it, there are enough legislation or there are enough laws or rules and regulations within the UN setup to deal with it. It's a question of it not being reported properly, and people are making noise about it. If you get the real facts and whatnot, these things will go away, because those who have been found and reported have been dealt with and dealt with very well. The abuses will come, and it needs two sides of the same coin to deal with it. Whilst we are educating people, that is a carrot, we should be punitive in our measures.
Right, let's look at another important function of the United Nations, that is peacekeeping. What can be done to improve peacekeeping operations of the United Nations?
Basically, it has come to stay. It is illegal, if you want to call it, because there is no place in the charter where it's written that there should be peacekeeping. The United Nations should have had its own army. It couldn't, because of the East-West confrontation, you know, the ideological struggle. That's number one. Number two, the people the coalitions that we form under the UN can be likened to mercenaries. But gradually, they've won their way into the UN system. That is, we call it Chapter 6.5. And since it has been accepted as part of international norm, what we need to do is to try and build standby forces in the region. Africa is trying to do that. We have the African standby force, where you have ECOWAS standby force, SADC standby force. So interventions will be quicker, easier, and faster.
Mm.
What is happening is that the UN can mobilize in about 6 months. When there is a problem anywhere, the UN can never mobilize within a short period. And that is why at times America and others are able to go in that way. Mobilization is very difficult, because you need a coalition of the willing. You need people to say, I want to offer troops and things like that. And then it's costly. So nations are not always very eager just to put their own bill before the UN reimburses. So to improve the UN peacekeeping force, I think the UN need to be a little defeated, to allow the regional forces to be able to strengthen themselves. And it should be easier for the UN then to help the regional forces.
Right. Doc, we appreciate your time with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Vladimir Nkudansu is a senior research fellow, Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. And still on international affairs, Ghana is training a contingent of 90 policemen to be redeployed to Somalia to support the African Union peacekeeping mission in the Horn of Africa. The police contingent is currently undergoing training at the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Training Center in Accra. DSP Sefa Sata speaks for the Ghana Police Service. DSP, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Right. You have 90 policemen undergoing peacekeeping training and are expected to be redeployed to Somalia. Is that right?
Good evening to your listeners. I intend this comment by me to be very brief on this topic. We have heard it that there are some police officers, 90 in all, undergoing some training at Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center, awaiting deployment to Somalia. Mind check with a very reliable source at the police headquarters indicates that the statement or the allegation is not true. Though we in fact have some police officers, numbering 90, and are going some training there, they are not due for deployment to Somalia. That is what my information is. People seem to have been agitated by the idea that police officers are going to be deployed to Somalia, and because of what happened in Kenya as a result of their contribution of troops to the Kenyan situation. But even in that sense, let me say that what the police go to mission to do is entirely different from what the military go there to do. The police only go there, mainly go there to help in reconstruction and reorganization after the situation has calmed down, and therefore are not necessarily engaged in armed combat like our colleagues from the military do. So people should be rest assured that there's nothing of the sort, and that the allegation that we are due for deployment to Somalia from Encheck is not true.
So DSP, what kind of training are they receiving and where will they be deployed?
Let me say that the AU, the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Training Center has a police directorate. And the AU have a program that every year police officers are given some training once in a year. And this is what the police officers are undergoing. It's the time for the police officers to undertake that training, and that is what I am told they are undergoing.
Right. Actually, you seem a bit coy on this particular subject. But what is wrong with the police deploying men to Somalia? We all know that Al-Shabaab is a name that sends shivers down the spine of every Ghanaian. What is wrong? Don't you have the mandate to send the police to peacekeeping operations in the Horn of Africa?
We do have the mandate, but I don't know why it looks as if Ghanaians, some people are panicking at the hearing of the fact that police are being deployed. And many radio stations have called me on this issue, and I can just imagine the alarm that they are trying to raise. And I think it's about time we clear the air to let them know. When duty calls, we deploy to AU and UN mission all over the country, all over the world. But I must say that my check indicates that this particular is not necessarily due for deployment.
Right, DSP, would you say, is it a case of the police shifting its position because of perhaps a public outcry against sending troops to Somalia?
No, not at all. To the best of my knowledge, we are not shifting any such distance. I mean, we deploy to all over Africa, all over the world. If that is the case, why not?
Right, DSP, we'd want to thank you very much. DSP Cephas Atta speaks for the Ghana Police Service. Security expert Emmanuel Suati, however, has some reservations about the redeployment of the police contingent to Somalia. Mr. Suati, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I'm sure you listened to DSP Cephas Atta. He has categorically denied any such move by the Ghana Police Service. You may have heard it. Where did you get that information from?
Oh, but I thought you were the media person, so I should rather be asking you that question. That's the first thing. The second thing has to do with your assertion that I am against it. I think that we may have to recap what DSP said. I didn't get that portion very clear. Can you please recap what he said? You know, just summary.
He said that there are no such plans, and that the police contingents actually are at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center, but they are there for a different purpose. They are not there to be deployed to Somalia.
Oh, okay. So, if for the records, that's fine. When I heard the issue, I also went to the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Training Center. On their website, it was there, on their website, and I saw it myself. So, then there is a disconnect somewhere, because I saw it on the website of Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Training Center. And I'm sure others also saw it. When I heard it, I went and I cross-checked, and it was there. And I don't know whether you followed it through yourself. So if they are saying it's not true, that is fine, no problem.
Right.
Discussion closes. But I would not necessarily have said that I'm against the deployment. I think that normally everybody would be concerned that Ghana is part of the international community and Ghana have to play its role. And the role Ghana plays, for me, my intention is clear, that whatever role we play would make the ordinary Ghanaian safer, and will make the interest of Ghana as part of the international community more prominent. So whatever action we have to take, I think that it has to be in furtherance of our national security. wherever we decide that we are going to invest the blood of Ghanaians, security personnel, and the money of Ghana, I think that has to be directly related to our national security interests, short, medium, and long term. And one of the police service has said that it is not true, then that is fine. And I think I have to commend the police service for this. If somebody had made a mistake somewhere, they have come out to deny it. Let's keep that for the record and see what happens in the coming weeks and the coming months.
Right.
That is my take.
Right, but nevertheless, let's reenact this scenario. Will it be wrong for Ghana, for the Ghana Police Service to send the police, a contingent of policemen to Somalia within the context of the Al-Shabaab incident?
That's a difficult one. It's a difficult one because, you see, I believe in the policy of the UPFM, and I keep saying that I believe strongly in the UPFM, but I have a definition for the UPFM. If the UPFM means that, yes, you are part of the international community, you are going to contribute your intelligence, you are going to make sure your territory is not used by extremists to further their agenda. However, you also pay equal prominence on your peculiar challenges, your vulnerabilities, the state of your intelligence, the state of your security, and make sure that any action or inaction you take, any pronouncement by politicians, any commitment would take into cognizance the state of your intelligence, the state of your military, and the state of your country and your economy. And if you're able to balance the UPFM with also knowing that you're part of the international community and doing that guardedly, I think that that balance is very important for me. So for me, yeah, that is my stand. How do you do that? You do that by consulting seasoned and, in my view, retired diplomats, seasoned and retired security and intelligence team. They will tell you that, okay, you're going to make these commitments. At this time, you can do it, but these are the repercussions. At this time, we recommend that you tarry a little and do it down the lane when you have put certain structures and certain mechanisms internally to make sure that you can respond adequately to extremists who might want to retaliate. Because, you see, I believe that every country's first security interest, both home and abroad, are your people, are the human beings, not the gold and not the big multinational companies your citizens may have, but the human resource, your ability to protect your human resource, to provide, for example, good health for them, education for the business entrepreneur, very good laws and very good environment for them to develop. Those, for me, are very strong national security issues. So whatever action you take, whether by pressure from, you know, outside or from the sub-region, you should consider all this in making sure that, yes, you're part of the international community, but you also not forget to deal with UPFM.
This is what I would say an oft-repeated question, but let's seek a quick one from you. What must we do as a country to protect ourselves from terrorist attacks?
No, I think they are the hard side of the security and the soft side. The hard side, you make sure that you provide avenue for the youth to have a future through entrepreneurial skills. Your educational system would support people who would want to further their education. Those who cannot go through the ladder, you know, to the very top, you have a vocational and, once again, entrepreneurial skills for them. Why am I saying that? Because, you see, when you have a vast number of youth who are unemployed and do not see the future quite clear, and they think they're going to be in the poverty cycle, you can even manipulate those people. I'm not saying necessarily that the fact that you are poor will make you a criminal. You cannot draw that conclusion. However, you make the youth vulnerable. The good news is that you have a lot of youth, but they have the potential to be innovative when they are supported. They have the potential to think outside the box. They have the potential to support visions and run with visions. And I think those are the things we can harness. If you have those strategies in place, you make it more difficult for them to be radicalized, for them to be easily manipulated by people, religious, political, ethnic, and other underpinnings that people make.
Right.
If you have the hard side, which is that you strengthen your security, your intelligence, your special forces, and ordinary people understanding that they have a role to play.
Right. I would want to thank you very much for talking to us. Emmanuel Suati is a security expert. And now to our next story. In an era where labor agitations have been an everyday affair, with labor unions using strikes as a bargaining chip to get government to kowtow to their demands, many have questioned why the Labor Commission has not been effective in dealing with some of these labor issues all over the place. A six-member commission was today inaugurated in Accra and is yet to be seen if they have the magic wand to turn around all the labor problems in the country. We have on the line a labor consultant, Mohammed Afum, to share his thoughts with us. Assalamu alaikum, Mr. Afum. Inauguration of a six-member labor commission. Should we expect a reduction in the numerous agitations?
Well, it depends on how the reconstituted labor commission proceeds to work. But then I expect that their first assignment should be to resolve all the outstanding industrial disputes that have resulted in strikes of late. In the course of resolving disputes over the few months, the commission has not acquitted itself much. So I think that this new body should look back, examine how the old commission could not work effectively, and chart put in strategies that will ensure that it becomes relevant to industrial relations in this country.
You are a labor consultant, Mr. Afum. Why couldn't the old commission work effectively?
See, the commission has challenges. One of them is that it is not well-funded. As we speak now, the commission has been in existence since 2006, but it has only two offices, one in Accra and one in Sekendi Takoradi, which means that any person who has a dispute in Takwa, in Bole, in Bologatanga, or Aflawo will have to travel to Accra for a resolution. And it puts a lot of strain on petitioners as well as respondents. Again, the commission lacks staff. The industrial relations officers who are there and who have been assisting to resolve disputes through facilitation or mediation are very few. Besides, they have not even been trained well. They have been trained on the job and they are doing marvelously well. I believe that they need to be taken through education because the commission is a quasi-judicial institutions. They should know the law of contract and other things so that when matters come before them, they can resolve them without due reference to the commissioners. So you need to have offices. Again, the commission also needs to be restructured. Unlike Shraj, those district officers can resolve disputes, then refer them to the commission for approval. The Labor Commission, by a Supreme Court decision involving Crocodile Matters and the commission, ruled that any matter that involves normal settlement must be presided over by the commissioners themselves, representing the tripartite partners, organized labor, employers, and government. However, what that ruling forgot is that the commissioners are not permanent members. They are all part-timers, and therefore, they are not able to sit regularly. So you have a lot of cases that have been piling up at the commission. You go to the commission on Wednesdays, it appears as if it's a market. So the commission needs to retool itself, needs to readapt itself and restructure itself so that it will be relevant to the times. And as I believe that now this new commission should engage the tripartite committee to look at the structure of the commission itself and the way out. Currently, there is something, a certain power imbalance in the commission. The executive secretary is he is supposed to be the chief executive of the commission, yet he has been, as it were, domesticated by the commissioners who are only board members because their understanding is that they are there to settle disputes. So the executive secretary is more or less a clerk. Has no relevance there. So the commission needs to revamp itself, restructure itself, and this can only be done when the tripartite partners in labor meet, arrive at a consensus, and send the relevant bills or LIs to Parliament for a restructuring of the commission.
Right. Mr. Fu, you have enumerated a lot of challenges, which means the new commission automatically inherits the same problems. Will there be an end in sight to labor disputes despite the inauguration of this new commission, Mr. Fu?
Pardon, ask again.
I said you have enumerated numerous challenges that this new that the old commission had, which means the new commission automatically inherits the same problems. Would there be an end in sight to labor disputes despite the inauguration of this new commission?
As for labor disputes, like conflicts between individuals, they are inevitable in human relationships as well as industrial relations. But the most important thing is that when the disputes or the conflicts arise, they must be resolved. Now, the commission occasionally has not been consistent in the resolution of some of these things, and that has been the problem. Sometimes you find that an arbitration has taken place, yet you find that at another level, nothing has been done. And you begin to ask, is the commission up to the task? Again, the commission has also not been consistent in the way it wants to enforce the law. During the medical association strike sometime last year, the GMA were on strike, yet the commission was meeting them every day. In other places, they will tell that unless you call off the strike, you will not meet you. This double standard and inconsistency also has undermined the moral authority of the commission. We believe that when disputes come, they must be resolved, and the law has prescribed procedures for resolving the disputes. If the parties will abide by them, and the commission will be the presiding institution will be consistent and in doing what the law requires them to do, I believe that the disputes will come, but they will be resolved.
Right. We wish you could take us through the role of the Labour Commission in handling labour-related agitation, but we definitely would visit that issue later on. We want to thank you very much for your time. Mohamed Afum is a labour consultant, and Edward Karua is the Deputy General Secretary of the General Agricultural Workers Union, GAU. You're welcome, Mr. Karua.
Thank you, sir.
I'm sure I have your name right.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Good. So has the new six-member Labour Commission come as a positive news to worker unions?
Yeah, come again.
Has a new six-member Labour Commission, I'm sure you are aware that a new members have been inaugurated today. And so is it positive news? Would we say it's positive news to worker unions?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, we have been without a commission for some time now, since the old commissioner's term of office expired. So the coming into being of this new commission is a good news to all of us.
And has the Labour Commission in time past been that ineffective in dealing with worker concerns? What do you experience?
Well, for someone to be effective or an institution to be effective, it has to be measured against its capacity. And then if you look at the capacity of the National Labour Commission, it has been constrained by lack of resources and then personnel. So all these things are indeed certainly constrained its capacity. But one can say that it was effective to the extent of its ability, what it could do at that time, given the resources available to it, and then given the personnel available to it. I think the Labour Commission did well.
So what do you expect from this new commission in their dealings with grievances of workers?
Well, we expect that they will continue to ensure that workers' grievances are expeditiously executed. We also expect that government will inject more resources into the Labour Commission and then address its structural problems. And also it will add the number of Labour Commission in the regions, because we only have one in Accra. There's supposed to be one in Takoradi. Since then, it has not yet been inaugurated. We need another one in Kumasi, one in Tamale. Throughout the country, it is only when this is done that we could be seeing more and more and speedy resolution of workers' grievances. Because I expect that workers' grievances the number will continue to rise. And to rise here is not to say that problems have arisen, but it is only that people are now more and more aware that when it comes to workers' problems, the place to dispose of them or to seek resolution is in the National Labour Commission. So more people will now move to the National Labour Commission with their issues to be resolved. So in that case, the number will increase, and indeed, giving this fact, then we even need to increase capacity of the National Labour Commission to be able to do that. And therefore, we need to spread to the region.
Mm. Mr. Kariya, others believe it's business as usual, since the old challenges still exist.
Well, it will be premature for one to conclude that it will be business as usual, just because all problems exist. These are new people who are coming in. They have different capacities to be able to address the whole issues. Even though we would like that the old problems which bedeviled the old commission should not be there again, but it would just be hasty conclusion to think that since the old problems have not been resolved, the new commissioners will just wallow in them and will not be able to do much.
Mr. Kariya, we appreciate your time with us. Edward Kariya is the Deputy General Secretary of the General Agricultural Workers Union, GAU. And also joining the discussion is Chairman of the Ghana Federation of Labour, Ibrahim Kumsen. Mr. Kumsen, you're welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you very much.
Would you say we are out of all our labour problems with the inauguration of a new labour commission to probably deal with the numerous labor agitations?
That is our expectation, because the situation over the past, since the beginning of the year, has been worrying. And we expect that things will change so that, you know, these labor agitations will subside. We know we cannot, you know, eliminate, you know, this kind of problems, but we wish that it to be minimized so that we have a harmonious industrial environment which will, you know, help the growth of the economy.
Mm. Mr. Kumsen, what makes you optimistic this commission will deliver the goods?
You see, that's why DFR has been so much concerned about the selection of the chairman, because the chairman has a lot of, you know, authority to ensure that things are done right. That's why in the selection process, we expected that right things should be done. Not that somebody with some interest will go behind and push, you know, somebody to take that position. And so far, we have not been understood by people. They think that we have, you know, something against a particular person who is going to head the place. And it's really, really, you know, unfortunate. I feel very sad that people would think that way. When we had met as an organized labor group, we have agreed that we should put in place a committee to vet prospective, you know, candidates, I should say, so that in the end, we come up with somebody who will understand issues well, somebody that we will have confidence in. It's not about that. I mean, having confidence in whoever is in charge. But if people will short-circuit the process and get somebody to take that position, that's the problem that we have. And they think that we are against a particular, we are not against any particular person, but, you know, the system is such that if you don't exhaust the process and you go behind and do certain things, eventually that person will not be accountable to anybody, and then you will sit there and do his or her own things. That's the problem that we have.
Mm.
You see, that's the problem that we have.
Mr. Kumsen, some people going behind, some people short circuiting, to quote you. Can you substantiate your claims? Sounds a bit vague.
No, you see, the TUC Secretary General did something that I feel bad about it. And for us, the thing that we are in the 18th century where things were done the way we wanted to do it. Now, you know, democracy is about the due process. It's about the rule of law. So if the Labour Act makes provision for a process to be followed, to arrive at something, and somebody goes behind and do a different thing, that's my worry.
Where somebody means?
Because you see, we met as organized labor. Because the law says that organized labor and the employer association should come up with a nominee to be appointed by the president for that position of chairmanship of the labor commission. The law, I mean, people who drafted the law, they knew what they were about. That's why they did all these things. So it means that we have to, you know, exercise due diligence in our selection. But the name of the person who has been appointed now was sent to the government or the presidency as far back as August, before GFL prompted the Secretary General Kouvesamwa of TEC that, look, it is getting late. Why don't we sit down and see how best we can, you know, come up with somebody's name. Quickly, a meeting of the organized labor was you know, held on 4th October, that was Friday, to discuss this issue. And at that forum, what we agreed was that, okay, let us put in place a committee, small committee, to vet the prospective, you know, applicants. Then this committee did not work. The next time that we heard that there had been another meeting which GFL was not invited, and that they have agreed that the name that had been sent already, it should stay. Look, these things are not good for us. I mean, so me, I will talk about it. I don't hate anybody, but the right thing should be done.
Mm.
You see, and this thing has been done. If I'm praying, it is my prayer that, you know, that person should exercise the utmost discretion or whatever in, you know, adjudicating, you know, over grievances that are sent there. Because we have been, he doesn't go to the labor commission. We go there most of the time because of the sector that we represent. We go there almost every time. And we know the shortcomings of the commission. And that's why we were so much concerned about getting somebody who will be able to handle the place. But
right,
eventually he succeeded.
Right.
Mr.
Commissioner, I hope you don't personalize this. I also wish that you pray that the new commission succeeds despite any differences between the two organizations or groups. Let's thank you very much for talking to us. Abraham Kumsen is chairman of the Ghana Federation of Labour. And now to our next story. For years, we have enjoyed all the oils one can find on the market to either prepare our stews or fry our fish and chicken. Later in life, it is detected by medical experts that our overindulgence in oils or fats that are saturated contributed to our oiling hearts. But interesting but controversial, one British doctor has sought to debunk and delink cardiovascular or heart diseases to the consumption of saturated fats. Dr. Malhotra, a cardiologist, registrar at Croydon University Hospital in London, says the mantra that saturated fat must be removed to reduce the risk of cardio diseases has dominated dietary advice and guidelines for decades. To him, saturated fat has been demonized, and any link with heart disease is not fully supported by scientific evidence. In his research, sugar also contributes to heart diseases. So because of the bastardization of saturated fats, the food industry has replaced it with sugar. So how authentic is Dr. Malhotra's research and findings? And did he debunk what we have known for years in order to make a name for himself? We have one of our own heart experts on the line, in the person of Dr. Lawrence Cerebo of the National Cardiothoracic Center at Kolebu here in Accra. Doc, you're welcome.
Good evening, and good evening to your listeners.
It looks we have been cleared by this British doctor to consume our oil without holding back, Doc.
Well, I think, as you said at the introduction to the topic, is still controversial. So until it is well established, I think we should still be quite wary of eating too much saturated fats.
Because of the Right. In your numerous operations on surgeries at the cardio center, has it come out that the numerous ailments are fat consumption related?
Well, fat consumption, as far as heart diseases are concerned, is actually related to what we call coronary artery disease. That is the blood vessels that supply the heart. They are the coronary arteries. And when they are diseased, we say they have coronary artery disease. And consumption of saturated fatty acids so far has been linked to development of this, of course, along with a lot of other factors. So, as the books tell us, until new research debunks it, we know that eating too much saturated fatty acid can affect the heart by the development of coronary artery disease.
You sound cautious, Doc, in your submissions. That is the feeling I get. So would you advise that we should still avoid or eat saturated fat in moderation?
We should still avoid it. Remember, it's not only what you eat that results. There are a lot of other factors, you know, hypertension, diabetes, being obese, smoking, taking too much alcohol, physical inactivity, and the mere fact that you are a black person. You know, and also being the male gender, there are a lot of other factors that interplay to produce coronary artery disease of the heart. So, you know, having too much saturated fatty acid leading to high cholesterol levels and can also affect it. So these are, as much as possible, every factor that has been identified so far to contribute to the causation of coronary artery disease, you should try and avoid them. It's quite interesting that this research has come up, this debate rather has come up about saturated fatty acids being not too relevant in the causation of, we know very well that cholesterol gets deposited in the arteries to form plaques, and it is these plaques that block the blood vessels of the heart, leading to heart attacks, and like. So I think we should still err on the side of caution to avoid eating saturated fatty acid. We should rather change our diets to more fruits and more vegetables, which are unsaturated fatty acid.
Right, Doc, some of us are becoming a bit scary, but most of these researches look confusing. Today you are told don't eat this, tomorrow you are told you've been cleared to eat it. It sounds so confusing. Where should we look at now?
I think you should listen to both sides of the argument, weigh it, and then err on the side of caution. I think the answer to all this is moderation.
It's still a bit ambiguous, Doc, but I don't want us to go further.
In medicine, we say there is never, ever, never. Sometimes there's a lot of research that are done, and then years afterwards, the results are debunked. So, if you should rather be very careful. There is no absolute as far as medicine is concerned. Maybe there are some fats in certain food substances that he has seen where he practices, which as far as he's concerned has no relevance as far as heart disease are concerned, but we know very well, and it's well established, that if you avoid too much saturated fats in your diet, the chances of reducing heart diseases is increased.
Right, Doc, just hold on, we'll get back to you. So how concerned is the nutritionist about eating behavior of Ghanaians and the likely health effects those relating to the heart? You have to help us with some explanations on the issue. Naomi Sogbe, Nutrition Officer, Shai Usuduku District in the Greater Accra Region, has joined us on the line. Auntie Naomi, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Is the Ghanaian really concerned about what goes into his stomach by way of foods we eat?
Well, I will say yes and at the same time no. Because yes, for those who have the knowledge about the principle of eating well. But those who don't have the knowledge may eat anyhow. So, I would say yes and at the same time, no.
Right. So which kinds of foods expose us to ailments?
You're asking of food that is good for us.
That expose us to ailments. Which kinds?
You know, the food that we eat, the food, we have three food groups. We have the energy-giving food, we have the body-building food, and we have the protective. In eating, all these three should come into play. So when you decide to eat one, leaving as the others, you, it may result in other conditions.
And how can we adopt good eating habits? We've had a lot of lessons about good eating habits. And it sounds confusing at times.
So how do we...
How do we adopt good eating habits?
It also comes to education. We need to educate and train our children from infancy. They should learn how to eat good so that when they grow with it. Because we have a saying that train a child in a way that when he grows, he will not depart from it. So if the children know from infancy that or from where when they are young, know that they are supposed to eat from these groups, they grow with it, and when they grow with it, they have it at the back of their mind, so they also educate their children as it continues. But if they don't have the knowledge, then the problems that we are seeing will still continue having it.
Right, madam, let's go back to Doc. Doc, you talked about moderation. Madam has also talked about moderation, but to quote you, you stated that we need to be careful. And careful is also a relative. So how do we measure the carefulness in what you were saying?
And simply speaking, as Madam said, you have energy-giving foods, you have the building, and then you have the protective. All these should be balanced. Again, we have to ensure that when we as when they are balanced, it should also be in moderation. One should not supersede the other. If you look, if you eat too much carbohydrate, it will affect your sugar. If you don't have enough protein, it will affect how you build up your body. And if you don't have the protective elements, your immunity will be affected. Again, all these things are derived from the three types of food that we have.
Right.
What we have to do as Ghanaians is to increase the amount of fruits and vegetables that we add to our diet, rather than having a lot of carbohydrate all the time.
Mm. Doc, let's narrow the discussion once again to heart diseases.
Yes.
Factors account for the increase in heart-related diseases?
You see, as far as diet is concerned, usually we are talking about coronary artery disease, as I said earlier, and sometimes the heart muscle itself can also be sick, what we call cardiomyopathy, especially in people who imbibe too much alcohol. But when it comes to diet, we're talking about coronary artery disease. This it's not only the diet that affects it. You know, as I said earlier, hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, obesity, physical inactivity, and some other factors also affect this. So these all create the coronary artery disease that unfortunately, it's becoming more rampant in our society.
Right, Doc. How can an individual identify signs of heart conditions before the situation becomes or gets complicated?
It depends on which heart condition, but what we are talking about, I think, is related to coronary artery disease. It's usually an affliction of the elderly, but unfortunately, we are getting younger and younger people who are getting it. Those people who have it generally complain of chest pain, especially when they exert themselves. And this chest pain goes away when whatever is precipitating it is removed. So let's say you are walking at a normal pace, you are okay, but when you want to hurry up, when you want to climb the stairs, when you want to jog or you want to run, you start feeling some pain in your chest. Sometimes it's not just pain, but you have some heaviness on the chest, you have some constricting feeling in the chest, you know. This is what we call angina.
Doc, you're making some of us a bit scary. I, for instance, hardly eat any food. So quickly, your advice to Ghanaians.
Oh well, you see, you should have what we call a heart healthy diet. That is high in fruits and vegetables. You should avoid smoking. If you need to drink, you have to drink in moderation, and you should exercise. Maintain your weight. And then one other thing we should do as Ghanaians is that we should know our numbers. When we say know your numbers, we are talking about know your blood pressure, so that if it is high, you can do something about it. Know your sugar levels, so that you can also do something about it if it goes up. You should know your weight, from where we calculate what we call the body mass index, so that you can control your weight. If you do this, you have what we call a heart healthy lifestyle.
Others also believe no matter what you do, when the time is right for you to go, you would go. But Doc, on that note, we would want to...
Well, if you want to go there, then I think we should also add prayers.
Right, Doc, we want to thank you very much for talking to us. Dr. Lawrence Sribo of the Dr. Lawrence Sribo of the National Cardiothoracic Center at Kwalebu Teaching Hospital. Auntie Naomi, I'm sure you're still on the line.
Yes, I'm still on the line.
So tell us, what is balanced diet in Ghanaian context? Balanced diet.
Balanced diet, as I said, is just about the principle I just told you that we should have the three food groups. For example, when we take a vegetarian, a typical vegetarian, when you talk about balanced diet, you have your danku, which is coming from the energy-giving food. Then we have your guitar school boys, that is coming from the protein. Then you have your goma, the vegetables. So when you put all those things together, and after eating, you get some fruit on it, then actually you have balanced your diet.
Mm. Madam, let me ask you a quick one. I eat fufu bankun all the time for so many years. I don't eat fruits, and yet I'm still strong. Would you still recommend that I eat fruits, all the time?
Yes, it is very important. For example, like green leafy vegetables, we have a lot of iron in them. So you may think you are healthy, you are strong. Because you've not been to the hospital to check, you can be anemic as you are there, but you didn't know. You see? But the food that we have vitamin C. It's the vitamin C that helps even absorb the iron from the green leafy vegetable. So if you eat only the carbohydrate and protein without eating the vegetable, there are this lots of minerals and vitamins. You get them from the fruits and vegetables, so it means you are lacking there, and that is you are reducing your immune system.
You're making some of us scary, but we have no choice than to listen to advice.
Yes.
So we'd want to thank you very much, Madam Naomi Sogbe, who is a nutritionist from the Shai Usuduku District in the Greater Accra Region. So that's how we draw the curtains on today's edition of the program. We are back same time tomorrow. Our producers have been Christopher Asidu, Edmond Tete, Bright Agama, Agatha Asamoah, Felix Kofi, and Celestine Avi, with our technician Isaac Yao Adu, and our summarizer Doreen Ampofo. My name is Ibrahim Kwateng.